the time this book was first published, and deals mainly with the effects of those wartime regulations which the Labor government made permanent. It is above all in the city that the province of the optional is felt as dwindling away to nothing. At school, in the place of work, on the journey to and fro, even in the very equipment and provisioning of the home, many of the activities normally possible to human beings are either forbidden or enjoined. Special agencies, called citizens' advice bureaus, are set up to steer the bewildered through the forest of rules, and to indicate to the persistent the rare clearings where a private person may still make a choice. The town lad is conditioned not to lift a finger without referring mentally to the book of words first. A time budget of an ordinary city youth for an ordinary working day would show that he spends great stretches of his waking hours going through motions that have been predetermined for him by directives in whose framing he has had no part, whose precise intention he seldom understands, and of whose appropriateness he cannot judge. The inference that what the city lad needs is more discipline and tighter control is too hasty. It would be nearer the mark to say that he is suffering from an overdose of control already. Surveying his parents and his older brothers and sisters, he finds them as regulation-bound as himself. He sees them so acclimatized to that state that they seldom plan and carry out under their own steam any new social excursion or enterprise. He thus looks forward to no future period at which a sinewy faculty of responsibility is likely to be of service to himself or others. The young people are obliged to stomach so much external and, as it seems to them, meaningless control that they seek escape and recuperation in an absence of discipline as complete as they can make it. L. J. Barnes, Youth Service in an English County, a report prepared for King George's Jubilee Trust, London, 1945. Is it too pessimistic to fear that a generation grown up under these conditions is unlikely to throw off the fetters to which it has grown used? Or does this description not rather fully bear out de Tocqueville's prediction of the new kind of servitude when, after having thus successively taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioned him at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community? It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters cannot penetrate to rise above the crowd. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people, till each nation is reduced to be nothing better than a flock of timid and industrial animals, of which government is the shepherd. I have always thought that servitude of the regular, quiet, and gentle kind, which I have just described, might be combined more easily than is commonly believed with some of the outward forms of freedom, and that it might even establish itself under the wing of the sovereignty of the people. Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, Part 2, Book 4, Chapter 6. The whole chapter should be read in order to realize with what acute insight de Tocqueville was able to foresee the psychological effects of the modern welfare state. It was, incidentally, de Tocqueville's frequent reference to the new servitude which suggested the title of the present book. What de Tocqueville did not consider was how long such a government would remain in the hands of benevolent despots when it would be so much more easy for any group of ruffians to keep itself indefinitely in power by disregarding all the traditional decencies of political life. Perhaps I should also remind the reader that I have never accused the socialist parties of deliberately aiming at a totalitarian regime, or even suspected that the leaders of the old socialist movements might ever show such inclinations. What I have argued in this book, and what the British experience convinces me even more to be true, is that the unforeseen but inevitable consequences of socialist planning create a state of affairs in which, if the policy is to be pursued, totalitarian forces will get the upper hand. I explicitly stress that socialism can be put into practice only by methods of which most socialists disapprove, and even add that in this the old socialist parties were inhibited by their democratic ideals, and that they did not possess the ruthlessness required for the performance of their chosen task. I am afraid the impression one gained under the Labour government was that these inhibitions were, if anything, weaker among the British socialists than they had been among their German fellow socialists 25 years earlier. Certainly, the German Social Democrats, in the comparable period of the 1920s, under equally or more difficult economic conditions, never approached as closely to totalitarian planning as the British Labour government has done. Since I cannot here examine the effect of these policies in detail, I will rather quote the summary judgments of other observers who may be less suspect of preconceived opinions. Some of the most damning, in fact, come from men who not long before had themselves been members of the Labour Party. Thus, Mr. Ivor Thomas, in a book apparently intended to explain why he left that party, comes to the conclusion that, from the point of view of fundamental human liberties, there is little to choose between communism, socialism, and national socialism. They all are examples of the collectivist or totalitarian state, in its essentials, not only is completed socialism the same as communism, but it hardly differs from fascism. The Socialist Tragedy, London, Latimer House Limited, 1949, pages 241 and 242. The most serious development is the growth of a measure of arbitrary administrative coercion and the progressive destruction of the cherished foundation of British liberty, the rule of law, for exactly the reasons here discussed in Chapter 6. This process had, of course, started long before the last Labour government came into power, and had been accentuated by the war. But the attempts at economic planning under the Labour government carried it to a point which makes it doubtful whether it can be said that the rule of law still prevails in Britain. The new despotism, of which a Lord Chief Justice had warned Britain as long as 25 years ago, is, as The Economist recently observed, no longer a mere danger, but an established fact. In an article in the issue of June 19, 1954, discussing the report on the public inquiry ordered by the Minister of Agriculture into the disposal of land at Critchell Down, Command 9176, London, Her Majesty's Stationery Office, 1954. A document deserving the most careful study by all those interested in the psychology of a planning bureaucracy. It is a despotism exercised by a thoroughly conscientious and honest bureaucracy for what they sincerely believe is the good of the country. But it is, nevertheless, an arbitrary government, in practice free from effective parliamentary control. And its machinery would be as effective for any other than the beneficent purposes for which it is now used. I doubt whether it was much exaggerated when recently an eminent British jurist, in a careful analysis of these trends, came to the conclusions that in Britain today we live on the edge of dictatorship. Transition would be easy, swift, and it could be accomplished with complete legality. Already so many steps have been taken in this direction, due to the completeness of power possessed by the government of the day, and the absence of any real check, such as the terms of a written constitution or the existence of an effective second chamber, that those still to be taken are small in comparison. G. W. Keaton, The Passing of Parliament, London, 1952. For a more detailed analysis of the economic policies of the British Labour government and its consequences, I cannot do better than refer the reader to Professor John Jukes's Ordeal by Planning, London, Macmillan and Company, 1948. It is the best discussion known to me of a concrete instance of the phenomena discussed in general terms in this book. It supplements it better than anything I could add here, and spells out a lesson which is of significance far beyond Great Britain. It seems now unlikely that, even when another Labour government should come into power in Great Britain, it would resume the experiments in large-scale nationalisation and planning. But in Britain, as elsewhere in the world, The defeat of the onslaught of systematic socialism has merely given those who are anxious to preserve freedom a breathing space in which to re-examine our ambitions and to discard all those parts of the socialist inheritance which are a danger to a free society. Without such a revised conception of our social aims, we are likely to continue to drift in the same direction in which outright socialism would merely have carried us a little faster. F. A. Hayek. Preface to the 1976 edition. This book, written in my spare time from 1940 to 1943, while my mind was still mainly occupied with problems of pure economic theory, has unexpectedly become for me the starting point of more than 30 years' work in a new field. This first attempt in the new direction was caused by my annoyance with the complete misinterpretation in English progressive circles of the character of the Nazi movement, an annoyance which led me from a memorandum to the then director of the London School of Economics, Sir William Beveridge, through an article in the Contemporary Review for 1938, which, at the request of Professor Harry G. Gideons of the University of Chicago, I enlarged for publication in his public policy pamphlets, and which, finally and reluctantly, when I found that all my more competent British colleagues were preoccupied with more urgent problems of the conduct of the war, I expanded into this tract for the Times. In spite of the wholly unexpected success of the book, in the case of the initially not contemplated American edition, even greater than in that of the British one, I felt for a long time not altogether happy about it. Though I had frankly declared at the outset of the book that it was a political one, I was made to feel by most of my fellow social scientists that I had used my abilities on the wrong side, and I was myself uncomfortable about the possibility that, in going beyond technical economics, I might have exceeded my competence. I will not speak here about the fury which the book caused in certain circles, or of the curious difference between its reception in Great Britain and that in the United States. About that I did say something 20 years ago in the preface to the first American paperback edition. Just to indicate the character of a widespread reaction, I will mention merely that one well-known philosopher, who shall be nameless, wrote to another to reproach him for having lauded this scandalous book, which, of course, he had not read. But though I tried hard to get back to economics proper, I could not free myself of the feeling that the problems on which I had so undesignedly embarked were more challenging and important than those of economic theory, and that much that I had said in my first sketch needed clarification and elaboration. When I wrote the book, I had by no means sufficiently freed myself from all the prejudices and superstitions dominating general opinion, and even less had I learned to avoid all the prevalent confusions of terms and concepts of which I have since become very conscious. And the discussion of the consequences of socialist policies which the book attempts is, of course, not complete without an adequate account of what an appropriately run market order requires and can achieve. It was to the latter problem that the further work I have since done in the field was mainly devoted. The first result of these efforts of explaining the nature of an order of freedom was a substantial book called The Constitution of Liberty, 1960, in which I essentially attempted to restate and make more coherent the doctrines of classical 19th-century liberalism. The awareness that such a restatement left certain important questions unanswered led me then to a further effort to provide my own answers in a work of 3 volumes entitled Law, Legislation, and Liberty, of which the first volume appeared in 1973. In the last 20 years, I have, I believe, learned much about the problems discussed in this book, though I don't think I ever reread the book during this time. Having done so now for the purpose of this preface, I feel no longer apologetic, but for the first time am rather proud of it, and not least of the insight which made me dedicate it to the socialists of all parties. Indeed, though I have in the interval learned much that I did not know when I wrote it, I was now often surprised by how much I did already see at the beginning of my efforts that later work has confirmed. And though my later efforts will, I hope, be more rewarding to the expert, I am now prepared unhesitatingly to recommend this early book to the general reader who wants a simple and non-technical introduction to what I believe is still one of the most ominous questions which we have to solve. The reader will probably ask whether this means that I am still prepared to defend all the main conclusions of this book, and the answer to this is, on the whole, affirmative. The most important qualification I must add is that, during the interval of time, terminology has changed, and for this reason, what I say in the book may be misunderstood. At the time I wrote, socialism meant unambiguously the nationalization of the means of production and the central economic planning which this made possible and necessary. In this sense, Sweden, for instance, is today very much less socialistically organized than Great Britain or Austria, though Sweden is commonly regarded as much more socialistic. This is due to the fact that socialism has come to mean chiefly the extensive redistribution of incomes through taxation and the institutions of the welfare state. In the latter kind of socialism, the effects I discuss in this book are brought about more slowly, indirectly, and imperfectly. I believe that the ultimate outcome tends to be very much the same, although the process by which it is brought about is not quite the same as that described in this book. It has frequently been alleged that I have contended that any movement in the direction of socialism is bound to lead to totalitarianism. Even though this danger exists, this is not what the book says. What it contains is a warning that, unless we mend the principles of our policy, some very unpleasant consequences will follow, which most of those who advocate these policies do not want. Where I now feel I was wrong in this book is chiefly in that I rather understressed the significance of the experience of communism in Russia, a fault which is perhaps pardonable when it is remembered that, when I wrote, Russia was our wartime ally, and that I had not wholly freed myself from all the current interventionist superstitions, and in consequence still made various concessions which I now think unwarranted. And I certainly was not yet fully aware how bad things already were in some respects. I still regarded it, for example, as a rhetorical question when I asked, page 82, if Hitler had obtained his unlimited powers in a strictly constitutional manner, who would suggest that the rule of law still prevailed in Germany? Only to discover later that Professors Hans Kelsen and Harold J. Lasky, and probably many other socialist lawyers and political scientists following these influential authors, had maintained precisely this. Quite generally, further study of the contemporary trends of thought and institutions has, if anything, increased my alarm and concern. And both the influence of socialist ideas and the naive trust in the good intentions of the holders of totalitarian power have markedly increased since I wrote this book. I have long resented being more widely known by what I regarded as a pamphlet for the time than by my strictly scientific work. After re-examining what I wrote then in the light of some 30 years' further study of the problems then raised, I no longer do so. Though the book may contain much that I could not, when I wrote it, have convincingly demonstrated, it was a genuine effort to find the truth which I believe has produced insights that will help even those who disagree with me to avoid grave dangers. F. A. Hayek. Introduction. Few discoveries are more irritating than those which expose the pedigree of ideas. Lord Acton. Contemporary events differ from history in that we do not know the results they will produce. Looking back, we can assess the significance of past occurrences and trace the consequences they have brought in their train. But while history runs its course, it is not history to us. It leads us into an unknown land, and but rarely can we get a glimpse of what lies ahead. It would be different if it were given to us to live a second time through the same events with all the knowledge of what we have seen before. How different would things appear to us? How important and often alarming would changes seem that we now scarcely notice? It is probably fortunate that man can never have this experience, and knows of no laws which history must obey. Yet, although history never quite repeats itself. And just because no development is inevitable, we can, in a measure, learn from the past to avoid a repetition of the same process. One need not be a prophet to be aware of impending dangers. An accidental combination of experience and interest will often reveal events to one man under aspects which few yet see. The following pages are the product of an experience as near as possible to twice living through the same period, or at least twice watching a very similar evolution of ideas. While this is an experience one is not likely to gain in one country, it may, in certain circumstance, be acquired by living in turn for long periods in different countries. Though the influences to which the trend of thought is subject in most civilized nations are, to a large extent, similar, they do not necessarily operate at the same time or at the same speed. Thus, by moving from one country to another, one may sometimes twice watch similar phases of intellectual development. The senses have then become peculiarly acute. When one hears for a second time opinions expressed or measures advocated, which one has first met 20 or 25 years ago, they assume a new meaning as symptoms of a definite trend. They suggest, if not the necessity, at least the probability, that developments will take a similar course. It is necessary now to state the unpalatable truth that it is Germany whose fate we are in some danger of repeating. The danger is not immediate, it is true, and conditions in England and the United States are still so remote from those witnessed in recent years in Germany as to make it difficult to believe that we are moving in the same direction. Yet, though the road be long, it is one on which it becomes more difficult to turn back as one advances. If, in the long run, we are the makers of our own fate, in the short run, we are the captives of the ideas we have created. Only if we recognize the danger in time can we hope to avert it. It is not to the Germany of Hitler, the Germany of the present war, that England and the United States bear yet any resemblance. But students of the currents of ideas can hardly fail to see that there is more than a superficial similarity between the trend of thought in Germany during and after the last war and the present current of ideas in the democracies. There exists now in these countries certainly the same determination that the organization of the nation which has been achieved for purposes of defense shall be retained for the purposes of creation. There is the same contempt for 19th-century liberalism, the same spurious realism and even cynicism, the same fatalistic acceptance of inevitable trends. And at least 9 out of every 10 of the lessons which our most vociferous reformers are so anxious we should learn from this war are precisely the lessons which the Germans did learn from the last war, and which have done much to produce the Nazi system. We shall have opportunity in the course of this book to show that there are a large number of other points where at an interval of 15 to 25 years we seem to follow the example of Germany. Although one does not like to be reminded, it is not so many years since the socialist policy of that country was generally held up by progressives as an example to be imitated. Just as, in more recent years, Sweden has been the model country to which progressive eyes were directed. All those whose memory goes further back know how deeply, for at least a generation before the last war, German thought and German practice influenced ideals and policy in England and, to some extent, in the United States. The author has spent about half of his adult life in his native Austria, in close touch with German intellectual life, and the other half in the United States and England. In the latter period, he has become increasingly convinced that at least some of the forces which have destroyed freedom in Germany are also at work here, and that the character and the source of this danger are, if possible, even less understood than they were in Germany. The supreme tragedy is still not seen, that in Germany it was largely people of goodwill, men who were admired and held up as models in the democratic countries, who prepared the way for, if they did not actually create, the forces which now stand for everything they detest. Yet our chance of averting a similar fate depends on our facing the danger, and on our being prepared to revise even our most cherished hopes and ambitions if they should prove to be the source of the danger. There are few signs yet that we have the intellectual courage to admit to ourselves that we may have been wrong. Few are ready to recognize that the rise of fascism and Nazism was not a reaction against the socialist trends of the preceding period, but a necessary outcome of those tendencies. This is a truth which most people were unwilling to see, even when the similarities of many of the repellent features of the internal regimes in communist Russia and National Socialist Germany were widely recognized. As a result, many who think themselves infinitely superior to the aberrations of Nazism and sincerely hate all its manifestations work at the same time for ideals whose realization would lead straight to the abhorred tyranny. All parallels between developments in different countries are, of course, deceptive, but I am not basing my argument mainly on such parallels, nor am I arguing that these developments are inevitable. If they were, there would be no point in writing this. They can be prevented if people realize in time where their efforts may lead. But until recently, there was little hope that any attempt to make them see the danger would be successful. It seems, however, as if the time were now ripe for a fuller discussion of the whole issue. Not only is the problem now more widely recognized, there are also special reasons which at this juncture make it imperative that we should face the issues squarely. It will, perhaps, be said that this is not the time to raise an issue on which opinions clash sharply. But the socialism of which we speak is not a party matter, and the questions which we are discussing have little to do with the questions at dispute between political parties. It does not affect our problem that some groups may want less socialism than others, that some want socialism mainly in the interest of one group, and others in that of another. The important point is that if we take the people whose views influence developments, they are now in the democracies in some measure all socialists. If it is no longer fashionable to emphasize that we are all socialists now, this is so merely because the fact is too obvious. Scarcely anybody doubts that we must continue to move towards socialism, and most people are merely trying to deflect this movement in the interest of a particular class or group. It is because nearly everybody wants it that we are moving in this direction. There are no objective facts which make it inevitable. We shall have to say something about the alleged inevitability of planning later. The main question is where this movement will lead us. Is it not possible that if the people whose convictions now give it an irresistible momentum began to see what only a few yet apprehend, they would recoil in horror and abandon the quest which for half a century has engaged so many people of goodwill? Where these common beliefs of our generation will lead us is a problem not for one party, but for every one of us. A problem of the most momentous significance. Is there a greater tragedy imaginable than that, in our endeavor consciously to shape our future in accordance with high ideals, we should, in fact, unwittingly produce the very opposite of what we have been striving for? There is an even more pressing reason why, at this time, we should seriously endeavor to understand the forces which have created National Socialism. That this will enable us to understand our enemy and the issue at stake between us. It cannot be denied that there is yet little recognition of the positive ideals for which we are fighting. We know that we are fighting for freedom to shape our life according to our own ideas. That is a great deal, but not enough. It is not enough to give us the firm beliefs which we need to resist an enemy who uses propaganda as one of his main weapons, not only in the most blatant, but also in the most subtle forms. It is still more insufficient when we have to counter this propaganda among the people in the countries under his control and elsewhere, where the effect of this propaganda will not disappear with the defeat of the Axis powers. It is not enough if we are to show to others that what we are fighting for is worth their support, and it is not enough to guide us in the building of a new world safe against the dangers to which the old one has succumbed. It is a lamentable fact that the democracies, in their dealings with the dictators before the war, not less than in their attempts at propaganda and in the discussion of their war aims, have shown an inner insecurity and uncertainty of aim, which can be explained only by confusion about their own ideals and the nature of the differences which separated them from the enemy. We have been misled as much because we have refused to believe that the enemy was sincere in the profession of some beliefs which we shared, as because we believed in the sincerity of some of his other claims. Have not the parties of the left, as well as those of the right, been deceived by believing that the National Socialist Party was in the service of the capitalists and opposed to all forms of socialism? How many features of Hitler's system have not been recommended to us for imitation from the most unexpected quarters, unaware that they are an integral part of that system and incompatible with the free society we hope to preserve? The number of dangerous mistakes we have made before and since the outbreak of war, because we do not understand the opponent with whom we are faced, is appalling. It seems almost as if we did not want to understand the development which has produced totalitarianism, because such an understanding might destroy some of the dearest illusions to which we are determined to cling. We shall never be successful in our dealings with the Germans until we understand the character and the growth of the ideas which now govern them. The theory which is once again put forth, that the Germans as such are inherently vicious, is hardly tenable, and not very creditable, to those who hold it. It dishonors the long series of Anglo-Saxon thinkers who, during the last 100 years, have gladly taken over what was best, and not only what was best, in German thought. It overlooks the fact that, when 80 years ago John Stuart Mill was writing his great essay On Liberty, he drew his inspiration, more than from any other men, from two Germans, Goethe and Wilhelm von Humboldt, and forgets the fact that two of the most influential intellectual forebears of National Socialism, Thomas Carlyle and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, were a Scot and an Englishman. In its cruder forms, this view is a disgrace to those who, by maintaining it, adopt the worst features of German racial theories. As some people may think this statement exaggerated, the testimony of Lord Morley may be worth quoting, who in his Recollections speaks of the acknowledged point that the main argument of the essay On Liberty was not original but came from Germany. The problem is not why the Germans as such are vicious, which congenitally they are probably no more than other peoples, but to determine the circumstances which, during the last 70 years, have made possible the progressive growth and the ultimate victory of a particular set of ideas, and why, in the end, this victory has brought the most vicious elements among them to the top. Mere hatred of everything German instead of the particular ideas which now dominate the Germans is, moreover, very dangerous, because it blinds those who indulge in it against a real threat. It is to be feared that this attitude is frequently merely a kind of escapism, caused by an unwillingness to recognize tendencies which are not confined to Germany, and by a reluctance to re-examine, and if necessary to discard, beliefs which we have taken over from the Germans, and by which we are still as much deluded as the Germans were. It is doubly dangerous because the contention that only the peculiar wickedness of the Germans has produced the Nazi system is likely to become the excuse for forcing on us the very institutions which have produced that wickedness. The interpretation of the developments in Germany and Italy, about to be proffered in this book, is very different from that given by most foreign observers and by the majority of exiles from those countries. But if this interpretation is correct, it will also explain why it is almost impossible for a person who, like most of the exiles and the foreign correspondents of English and American newspapers, holds the now prevalent socialist views to see those events in the proper perspective. The superficial and misleading view, which sees in National Socialism merely a reaction fomented by those whose privileges or interests were threatened by the advance of socialism, was naturally supported by all those who, although they were at one time active in the movement of ideas that has led to National Socialism, have stopped at some point of that development and, by the conflict into which this brought them with the Nazis, were forced to leave their country, But the fact that they were numerically the only significant opposition to the Nazis means no more than that, in the wider sense, practically all Germans had become socialists, and that liberalism, in the old sense, had been driven out by socialism. As we hope to show, the conflict in existence between the National Socialist right and the left in Germany is the kind of conflict that will always arise between rival socialist factions. If this interpretation is correct, it means, however, that many of those socialist refugees, in clinging to their beliefs, are now, though with the best will in the world, helping to lead their adopted country the way which Germany has gone. I know that many of my Anglo-Saxon friends have sometimes been shocked by the semi-fascist views they would occasionally hear expressed by German refugees, whose genuinely socialist convictions could not be doubted. But while these observers put this down to the others being Germans, the true explanation is that they were socialists whose experience had carried them several stages beyond that yet reached by socialists in England and America. It is true, of course, that German socialists have found much support in their country from certain features of the Prussian tradition, and this kinship between Prussianism and socialism, in which, in Germany, both sides gloried, gives additional support to our main contention. That there did exist a certain kinship between socialism and the organization of the Prussian state, consciously organized from the top, as in no other country, is undeniable, and was freely recognized already by the early French socialists, long before the ideal of running the whole state on the same principles as a single factory was to inspire 19th-century socialism. The Prussian poet Novalis had already deplored that no other state has ever been administered so much like a factory as Prussia since the death of Frederick William. Cf. Novalis, Friedrich von Hardenberg, Glauben und Liebe, Order der König und der Königin, 1798. But it would be a mistake to believe that the specific German, rather than the socialist element, produced totalitarianism. It was the prevalence of socialist views and not Prussianism that Germany had in common with Italy and Russia, and it was from the masses and not from the classes steeped in the Prussian tradition and favored by it that National Socialism arose. Chapter 1. The Abandoned Road. A program whose basic thesis is not that the system of free enterprise for profit has failed in this generation, but that it has not yet been tried. F.D. Roosevelt. When the course of civilization takes an unexpected turn, when, instead of the continuous progress which we have come to expect, we find ourselves threatened by evils associated by us with past ages of barbarism, we naturally blame anything but ourselves. Have we not all striven according to our best lights, and have not many of our finest minds incessantly worked to make this a better world? Have not all our efforts and hopes been directed toward greater freedom, justice, and prosperity? If the outcome is so different from our aims, if instead of freedom and prosperity, bondage and misery stare us in the face, is it not clear that sinister forces must have foiled our intentions, that we are the victims of some evil power which must be conquered before we can resume the road to better things? However much we may differ when we name the culprit, whether it is the wicked capitalist or the vicious spirit of a particular nation, the stupidity of our elders, or a social system not yet, although we have struggled against it for half a century, fully overthrown, we all are, or at least were until recently, certain of one thing, that the leading ideas which during the last generation have become common to most people of goodwill and have determined the major changes in our social life cannot have been wrong. We are ready to accept almost any explanation of the present crisis of our civilization except one, that the present state of the world may be the result of genuine error on our own part, and that the pursuit of some of our most cherished ideals has apparently produced results utterly different from those which we expected. while all our energies are directed to bring this war to a victorious conclusion, it is sometimes difficult to remember that even before the war, the values for which we are now fighting were threatened here and destroyed elsewhere. Though for the time being the different ideals are represented by hostile nations fighting for their existence, we must not forget that this conflict has grown out of a struggle of ideas within what, not so long ago, was a common European civilization, and that the tendencies which have culminated in the creation of the totalitarian systems were not confined to the countries which have succumbed to them. Though the first task must now be to win the war, to win it will only gain us another opportunity to face the basic problems and to find a way of averting the fate which has overtaken kindred civilizations. Now, it is somewhat difficult to think of Germany and Italy, or of Russia, not as different worlds, but as products of a development of thought in which we have shared. It is, at least so far as our enemies are concerned, easier and more comforting to think that they are entirely different from us, and that what happened there cannot happen here. Yet the history of these countries in the years before the rise of the totalitarian system showed few features with which we are not familiar. The external conflict is a result of a transformation of European thought, in which others have moved so much faster as to bring them into irreconcilable conflict with our ideals, but which has not left us unaffected. That a change of ideas and the force of human will have made the world what it is now, though men did not foresee the results, and that no spontaneous change in the facts obliged us thus to adapt our thought as perhaps particularly difficult for the Anglo-Saxon nations to see, just because in this development they have, fortunately for them, lagged behind most of the European peoples. We still think of the ideals which guide us, and have guided us for the past generation, as ideals only to be realized in the future, and are not aware how far in the last 25 years they have already transformed not only the world, but also our own countries. We still believe that, until quite recently, we were governed by what are vaguely called 19th-century ideas, or the principle of laissez-faire. Compared with some other countries, and from the point of view of those impatient to speed up the change, there may be some justification for such belief. But although until 1931, England and America had followed only slowly on the path on which others had led, even by then they had moved so far that only those whose memory goes back to the years before the last war know what a liberal world has been like. Even in that year, the Macmillan Report could already speak of the change of outlook of the government of this country in recent times, its growing preoccupation, irrespective of party, with the management of the like of the people, and add that Parliament finds itself increasingly engaged in legislation which has for its conscious aim the regulation of the day-to-day affairs of the community, and now intervenes in matters formerly thought to be entirely outside its scope. This could be said before, later in the same year. England finally took the headlong plunge, and in the short space of the inglorious years 1931 to 1939, transformed its economic system beyond recognition. The crucial point of which our people are still so little aware is, however, not merely the magnitude of the changes which have taken place during the last generation, but the fact that they mean a complete change in the direction of the evolution of our ideas and social order. For at least 25 years before the specter of totalitarianism became a real threat, we had progressively been moving away from the basic ideas on which Western civilization has been built. That this movement on which we have entered with such high hopes and ambitions should have brought us face to face with the totalitarian horror has come as a profound shock to this generation, which still refuses to connect the two facts. Yet this development merely confirms the warnings of the fathers of the liberal philosophy which we still profess. We have progressively abandoned that freedom in economic affairs, without which personal and political freedom has never existed in the past. Although we had been warned by some of the greatest political thinkers of the 19th century, by de Tocqueville and Lord Acton, that socialism means slavery, we have steadily moved in the direction of socialism. And now that we have seen a new form of slavery arise before our eyes, we have so completely forgotten the warning that it scarcely occurs to us that the two things may be connected. Even much more recent warnings, which have proved dreadfully true, have been almost entirely forgotten. It is not yet 30 years since Hilaire Belloc, in a book which explains more of what has happened since in Germany than most works written after the event, explained that the effect of socialist doctrine on capitalist society is to produce a third thing different from either of its two begetters, to wit, the servile state. The Servile State, 1913, 3rd edition, 1927, page XIV. How sharp a break not only with the recent past, but with the whole evolution of Western civilization the modern trend toward socialism means, becomes clear if we consider it not merely against the background of the 19th century, but in a longer historical perspective. We are rapidly abandoning not the views merely of Cobden and Bright, of Adam Smith and Hume, or even of Locke and Milton, but one of the salient characteristics of Western civilization as it has grown from the foundations laid by Christianity and the Greeks and Romans. Not merely 19th and 18th century liberalism, but the basic individualism inherited by us from Erasmus and Montaigne, from Cicero and Tacitus, Pericles and Thucydides, is progressively relinquished. The Nazi leader who described the National Socialist Revolution as a counter-Renaissance spoke more truly than he probably knew. It was the decisive step in the destruction of that civilization which modern man had built up from the age of the Renaissance, and which was, above all, an individualist civilization. Individualism has a bad name today, and the term has come to be connected with egotism and selfishness. But the individualism of which we speak in contrast to socialism and all other forms of collectivism has no necessary connection with these. Only gradually, in the course of this book, shall we be able to make clear the contrast between the two opposing principles. But the essential features of that individualism which, from elements provided by Christianity and the philosophy of classical antiquity, was first fully developed during the Renaissance, and has since grown and spread into what we know as Western civilization, are the respect for the individual man qua man, that is, the recognition of his own views and tastes as supreme in his own sphere, however narrowly that may be circumscribed, and the belief that it is desirable that men should develop their own individual gifts and bents. Freedom and liberty are now words so worn with use and abuse that one must hesitate to employ them to express the ideals for which they stood during that period. Tolerance is, perhaps, the only word which still preserves the full meaning of the principle which, during the whole of this period, was in the ascendant, and which only in recent times has again been in decline, to disappear completely with the rise of the totalitarian state. The gradual transformation of a rigidly organized hierarchic system into one where men could at least attempt to shape their own life, where man gained the opportunity of knowing and choosing between different forms of life, is closely associated with the growth of commerce. From the commercial cities of northern Italy, the new view of life spread with commerce to the west and north, through France and the southwest of Germany, to the Low Countries and the British Isles, taking firm root wherever there was no despotic political power to stifle it. In the Low Countries and Britain, it, for a long time, enjoyed its fullest development, and for the first time had an opportunity to grow freely and to become the foundation of the social and political life of these countries. And it was from there that, in the late 17th and 18th centuries, it again began to spread, in a more fully developed form, to the west and east, to the New World and to the center of the European continent, where devastating wars and political oppression had largely submerged the earlier beginnings of a similar growth. The most fateful of these developments, pregnant with consequences not yet extinct, was the subjection and partial destruction of the German bourgeoisie by the territorial princes in the 15th and 16th centuries. During the whole of this modern period of European history, The general direction of social development was one of freeing the individual from the ties which had bound him to the customary or prescribed ways in the pursuit of his ordinary activities. The conscious realization that the spontaneous and uncontrolled efforts of individuals were capable of producing a complex order of economic activities could come only after this development had made some progress. The subsequent elaboration of a consistent argument in favor of economic freedom was the outcome of a free growth of economic activity, which had been the undesigned and unforeseen byproduct of political freedom. Perhaps the greatest result of the unchaining of individual energies was the marvelous growth of science, which followed the march of individual liberty from Italy to England and beyond. That the inventive faculty of man had been no less in earlier periods is shown by the many highly ingenious automatic toys and other mechanical contrivances constructed while industrial technique still remained stationary, and by the development in some industries which, like mining or watchmaking, were not subject to restrictive controls. But the few attempts toward a more extended industrial use of mechanical inventions, some extraordinarily advanced, were promptly suppressed, and the desire for knowledge was stifled, so long as the dominant views were held to be binding for all. The beliefs of the great majority on what was right and proper were allowed to bar the way of the individual innovator. Only since industrial freedom opened the path to the free use of new knowledge, only since everything could be tried, if somebody could be found to back it at his own risk, and, it should be added, as often as not from outside the authorities officially entrusted with the cultivation of learning, has science made the great strides which, in the last 150 years, have changed the face of the world. As is so often true, the nature of our civilization has been seen more clearly by its enemies than by most of its friends. The perennial Western malady, the revolt of the individual against the species, as that 19th-century totalitarian Auguste Comte has described it, was indeed the force which built our civilization. What the 19th century added to the individualism of the preceding period was merely to make all classes conscious of freedom, to develop systematically and continuously what had grown in a haphazard and patchy manner, and to spread it from England and Holland over most of the European continent. The result of this growth surpassed all expectations. Wherever the barriers to the free exercise of human ingenuity were removed, man became rapidly able to satisfy ever-widening ranges of desire. And while the rising standard soon led to the discovery of very dark spots in society, spots which men were no longer willing to tolerate, there was probably no class that did not substantially benefit from the general advance. We cannot do justice to this astonishing growth if we measure it by our present standards, which themselves result from this growth, and now make many defects obvious. To appreciate what it meant to those who took part in it, we must measure it by the hopes and wishes men held when it began, and there can be no doubt that its success surpassed man's wildest dreams, that by the beginning of the 20th century, the working man in the Western world had reached a degree of material comfort, security, and personal independence which, 100 years before, had seemed scarcely possible. What in the future will probably appear the most significant and far-reaching effect of this success is the new sense of power over their own fate, the belief in the unbounded possibilities of improving their own lot, which the success already achieved created among men. With the success grew ambition, and man had every right to be ambitious. What had been an inspiring promise seemed no longer enough, the rate of progress far too slow, and the principles which had made this progress possible in the past came to be regarded more as obstacles to speedier progress, impatiently to be brushed away, than as the conditions for the preservation and development of what had already been achieved. There is nothing in the basic principles of liberalism to make it a stationary creed. There are no hard and fast rules, fixed once and for all. The fundamental principle that in the ordering of our affairs we should make as much use as possible of the spontaneous forces of society and resort as little as possible to coercion is capable of an infinite variety of applications. There is, in particular, all the difference between deliberately creating a system within which competition will work as beneficially as possible and passively accepting institutions as they are. Probably nothing has done so much harm to the liberal cause as the wooden insistence of some liberals on certain rough rules of thumb, above all, the principle of laissez-faire. Yet, in a sense, this was necessary and unavoidable. Against the innumerable interests which could show that particular measures would confer immediate and obvious benefits on some, while the harm they caused was much more indirect and difficult to see, nothing, short of some hard and fast rule, would have been effective. And, since a strong presumption in favor of industrial liberty had undoubtedly been established, the temptation to present it as a rule which knew no exceptions was too strong always to be resisted. But, with this attitude taken by many popularizers of the liberal doctrine, it was almost inevitable that, once their position was penetrated at some points, it should soon collapse as a whole. The position was further weakened by the inevitably slow progress of a policy which aimed at a gradual improvement of the institutional framework of a free society. This progress depended on the growth of our understanding of the social forces and the conditions most favorable to their working in a desirable manner. Since the task was to assist, and where necessary to supplement, their operation, the first requisite was to understand them. The attitude of the liberal toward society is like that of the gardener who tends a plant, and, in order to create the conditions most favorable to its growth, must know as much as possible about its structure and the way it functions. No sensible person should have doubted that the crude rules in which the principles of economic policy of the 19th century were expressed were only a beginning, that we had yet much to learn, and that there were still immense possibilities of advancement on the lines on which we had moved. But this advance could come only as we gained increasing intellectual mastery of the forces of which we had to make use. There were many obvious tasks, such as our handling of the monetary system and the prevention or control of monopoly, and an even greater number of less obvious but hardly less important tasks to be undertaken in other fields, where there could be no doubt that the governments possessed enormous powers for good and evil, and there was every reason to expect that, with a better understanding of the problems, we should some day be able to use these powers successfully. But while the progress toward what is commonly called positive action was necessarily slow, and while for the immediate improvement liberalism had to rely largely on the gradual increase of wealth which freedom brought about, it had constantly to fight proposals which threatened this progress. It came to be regarded as a negative creed, because it could offer to particular individuals little more than a share in the common progress, a progress which came to be taken more and more for granted, and was no longer recognized as the result of the policy of freedom. It might even be said that the very success of liberalism became the cause of its decline. Because of the success already achieved, man became increasingly unwilling to tolerate the evils still with him, which now appeared both unbearable and unnecessary. Because of the growing impatience with the slow advance of liberal policy, the just irritation with those who used liberal phraseology in defense of antisocial privileges, and the boundless ambition seemingly justified by the material improvements already achieved, it came to pass that, toward the turn of the century, the belief in the basic tenets of liberalism was more and more relinquished. What had been achieved came to be regarded as a secure and imperishable possession, acquired once and for all. The eyes of the people became fixed on the new demands, the rapid satisfaction of which seemed to be barred by the adherence to the old principles. It became more and more widely accepted that further advance could be expected not along the old lines within the general framework, which had made past progress possible, but only by a complete remodeling of society. It was no longer a question of adding to or improving the existing machinery, but of completely scrapping and replacing it. And, as the hope of the new generation came to be centered on something completely new, Interest in and understanding of the functioning of the existing society rapidly declined. And with the decline of the understanding of the way in which the free system worked, our awareness of what depended on its existence also decreased. This is not the place to discuss how this change in outlook was fostered by the uncritical transfer to the problems